What can we learn about discrimination from Dr. Seuss or about standards of living from the Three Little Pigs? Plenty of children's books teach morals and lessons, but those morals and lessons can teach children about something more, their human rights. Our guest today, Jonathan Totris, co-authored the book Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination and the Narrative of Law. He's a law professor at Georgia State University and joins us in studio now. Jonathan, welcome to City Lights.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure. And you are a professor in the law school. So how did you intersect with children's literature?
Sure. In some respects, this project is a natural outgrowth of what I've done for many years, focusing on children's rights and thinking about how do we prevent harm from occurring in the first place. And in other respects, it really is a surprise, and even a surprise to me. I came to children's literature almost by accident. I was in the library one day reading about technical points of law, and I needed a break. And so I walked around the library to stretch my legs, and I saw Horton Hears a Who by Dr. Seuss, and remembered that from my childhood, so I thought I'd flip through the pages and came across that iconic line, a person's a person no matter how small, and I thought, that's a clearer explanation of core principles of human rights than any legal scholar or philosopher has come up with, at least that I was aware of. And So I started pulling children's books and exploring human rights themes, and along the way met my co-author, Sarah Higginbotham, and we decided to work on an article and then felt there was more to say, and that became this book.
So it's sort of a paraphrase on out of the mouths of babes, in your case, out of the mouths for babes or young children. And how did you and Sarah connect?
Also fortuitously, she attended a friend of hers from another university was giving a lecture at Georgia State University, and we happened to attend the same lecture and sit at the same table during lunch, and I heard she was doing a PhD in literature, so I thought I'll tell her about the literature project that I'm working on. And she was excited about it. She asked if she could just go away and think about it, and we met a few more times, and she had exciting ideas, and I think interdisciplinary work is really important, and so it soon became obvious that we should work together on the project.
Were your children born at that point?
That was just before my first child was born.
So it's not as though you had been reading that every night to your little boy and it was in your mind. You literally stumbled upon that Dr. Seuss book in the library.
Absolutely right. And so they didn't help me with the idea, but they've certainly informed. You know, we read to our children every night and often during the day, and they've certainly informed my thinking about the project.
Well, what motivated the work mainly was the Convention of the Child, which is the most broadly accepted human rights treaty. Would you talk about that, please?
Sure. It was adopted in 1989, and it was intended as a comprehensive statement on the rights of children. And every country in the world except the United States is now a party to that treaty.
Because we don't believe in children's rights?
Well, you know, the U.S. has had an interesting history with human rights treaties. Historically, they've been very strong proponents of the development of human rights treaties. The U.S. was arguably the most active delegation in drafting the treaty, and that was under the administrations of Reagan and Bush Sr. But they've been taking a much slower approach to actually then agreeing to be bound by those treaties.
Why?
There's some historical reasons, the sense that concerns about sovereignty, but those are not really realistic in the sense that we have joined many other treaties without any concerns about sovereignty. There's also a lot of misconception about the treaty. I think people mischaracterize children's rights often as a threat to parents. And in fact, children's rights and children's rights law can really help parents, and it's an opportunity for parents to advocate and have governments support what they want for their children.
I read in your book that in 1993 in Vienna, there was another conference, and the other countries that objected were China, Iran, Malaysia. Not the kind of, I mean, you wouldn't expect those countries and the U.S. to be in the same place on human rights.
Yeah, the U.S. has not always been in the best company with respect to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And, you know, the counter argument is always, well, we do better than many other countries with respect to children. And my response to that is always the comparative shouldn't be the answer, right? That we do better for children in this country as compared to Somalia or Sudan, which has much less in the way of resources, shouldn't make us feel better. What we should be asking is, can we do better than we're doing now? And I think human rights law provides a framework where we could use it to improve the well-being of children in this country.
So getting back to the literature, your book's title is Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination and the Narrative of Law. What was the objective of your book?
We were interested in two things. First of all, we wanted to better understand how do children learn about and understand their rights and their responsibilities to respect the rights of others. That was really the main goal. And then a secondary goal was to understand how do these international human rights norms ultimately make a difference in the lives of individuals, ordinary people in their day-to-day lives. How do we ensure that these lofty aims make a difference? But we were excited about sort of, and for the book, one of the things that we did is we added an empirical component. We read to children and we asked them what they thought about books because we felt it was important to hear from children and understand, do they see what we see in these books? And that was a really affirming part of the project. They're seeing human rights ideas in the stories they read and have read to them. They may not be describing them as technical points of law, but they're describing human rights ethics. And
give us some examples.
Well, we had this wonderful, we read the story of Ferdinand, which for those who don't recall is a story about a bull who doesn't want to fight. And for us in reading that book, we thought this is a book about identity rights, being who you are, being true to yourself. And the question for us was, do children think see the same thing? And very clearly, we read it to adolescents who, you know, identity is a big thing during adolescence. They saw that absolutely as a book about identity. And even younger children, we read it to middle school children, and they had the same idea about who can I be? Who do I want to be? And do I have the right to be that? Now, they didn't cite to some human rights law when they talked about it, but children's literature isn't about teaching law so much as it is about teaching the ethics and the ideas that are the foundation of human rights. And there, I think there's children's literature is really this wonderfully rich resource.
When you cite Ferdinand the Bull in the book and in your example just now, it brought to mind the movie The Blind Side. And that book, for me, I just loved it. And you know, it's mainly the story of this big guy who's a football player but has this gentle, sweet soul and doesn't like the identification that because he's big and brawny, he ought to be mowing down, you know, other football players. So you write about, and Sarah brings to light in the book, how children identify and see themselves as these characters. And something I found remarkable was the mention of how much more powerful fiction is for children in terms of how they perceive themselves. The characters in fictional stories are actually far more real to them than a historical account.
That's right. The imaginative world is really powerful for children. And if you spend any time with young children, you see that they often sort of move back and forth between the real and the imaginative very easily. We as adults struggle with that. We insist on these sort of clear boundaries. They're happily going back and forth. And There's great research showing the impact of fiction, and there's also a simple way to test this. You can ask, and I've asked students of mine, tell me about a case we read, a judicial opinion we read 6 weeks ago, and then tell me about a children's story you read 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the latter is ingrained in them in a way that nonfiction is not. And so I think that's another reason why we focused on children's literature. It's a really powerful, it has a powerful impact on children.
Talking with Professor Jonathan Todres of Georgia State University's School of Law. We'll be back in a moment. You're tuned to WABE Atlanta. Listening to City Lights on 90.1 and WABE.org. I'm Lois Reitzes here with you and Professor Jonathan Todres of Georgia State University School of Law. His book is Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination, and the Narrative of Law. How many books did you read and study for this project?
We included a little more than 500 books in this process, and we focused primarily on widely distributed books, the most popular books. And there are challenges with that. We started there because if the idea is how do you make human rights widely known, then you have to start with the books that are bestsellers. But we recognize also that if you focus on only the most popular, that you also you run the risk of leaving out marginalized voices that, you know, have historically not been included. So at times, and particularly, for example, in the chapter on discrimination and equality, we read much more broadly than the sort of bestsellers or widely known books. And so we were a little selective in places.
Yes. And in terms of representation, it's apparent in the book that you were aiming for a diverse range of characters and books that affect readers, but not always easy to come by, is it?
No, there's not a lot of diversity in children's literature, and there's been a recent push for more diverse books, and you know, I think books transmit, you know, as Walter Dean Myers, who wrote over 100 children's books, said, books transmit values. They're about our common humanity, and as he posed the question, what does it mean if people don't see themselves in these stories, in any of these stories? So there's a real need for a greater diversity, both among authors of children's books and also the characters themselves.
I was shocked in one part of the book where what seemed to be described as a book for babies, a thick cardboard book with images of children conveying emotion, the smiles and the crying and frowns, whatnot, that the positive emotions were all white faces.
That's right. That's right.
In this day and age, it's hard to believe.
And it's hard to know where that happened. You know, is it the matching adjectives with faces? You know, who is that, the author that's doing that? Is it the publisher? So it's hard to know sort of where the issue is, but it is surprising on some level that no editor noticed that all the positive attributes are, you know, on the page with the white child, and the children of color, you know, are associated with more negative attributes.
Which is one reason that fantasy characters like those in Dr. Seuss, or a series that my husband and I loved reading to our kids, was Francis, the little badger,
sure.
Russell Hoban, bread and jam
for
Francis,
yes.
A bargain for Francis, he's a little badger. So much safer with those fantasy creatures. And in your research, it seems that Dr. Seuss made a very positive impression on kids in terms of imparting proper values and ethics. Horton Hears a Who, Yertle the Turtle. What is so striking and effective about Dr. Seuss's writing?
Well, I think one of the most powerful things about Dr. Seuss is there's nothing in the text that's not in the image. So for very young children, it's empowering. They can follow the story. In fact, they are seeing the story play out often before the adult, the teacher, the parent is reading that particular line. And that the rhyme helps them anticipate what's coming and gets them really engaged. So it draws them in. I think the other thing about Dr. Seuss and other authors like Seuss is the story is foregrounded. This isn't your sort of very obvious, you know, the blue crayon and the yellow crayon don't get along, but all crayons are equal, right? That type of narrative is so obvious to children that they see through it and they don't engage it in the same way that they engage Seuss, where they are excited about the actual story and they can see the lesson in it as well.
So what comes to mind now is you've done all of this research that validates things, very, very heartening to know. Reading fosters, imparting better values, more reading when the child is of reading age, every positive attribute. But how about access for children who don't necessarily live in houses that are surrounded by books or where their parents necessarily have access to public libraries? I mean, when you're talking about human rights and the convention, you know, think about poor, underdeveloped countries. How do you get those kids? How can you read
sure.
to them?
So in sort of resource-limited families and communities, that is a challenge. I think we focus first on the U.S. in this book project, and then, you know, there are follow-on projects that I'm starting to think about. But I think the first step is we took some comfort knowing that children are still read to in school, and they're still exposed to it. They may not be exposed to as many books, but there's still some exposure. And reading in a classroom may not be the same as reading next to your parent. But we also live in the real world, and not every, you know, many parents work two jobs and, you know, they have limited time. So I think there are ways that you can help address that at an individual level. But I also think it's on us to address some of the structural challenges. And those are much bigger issues well beyond what we have time for today. But I think we need to address the fact that a lot of children don't have, or they have much more limited access to these materials. As far as beyond the U.S., I think one of the things that I'm really excited about is thinking about oral storytelling traditions in many countries and what stories are passed down. And that is the next project that I'm thinking about, looking at global perspectives on children's stories and what human rights themes are in both books, whether you're in Malawi, here reading books or listening to stories, folk tales, or whether you're reading South Korean fairy tales. I'm interested in global perspectives on the same questions.
And to your credit, to the credit of you and Sarah Higginbottom, you state forthright that any criticism of this as a U.S.-centric, if not class-centric study, is because you are heartened at the thought of this being the first part of a much larger puzzle and expanding out to other communities here and globally. It seems like it would be a daunting task in terms of oral storytelling, but I bet it would be fascinating if you could get the funding.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that idea. And, you know, I never thought I would finish a book and say, well, this might require, you know, 30 years more to capture all the different storytelling traditions. But there's a lot that I'm excited about. You know, I think I think about refugee populations and thinking about the stories that refugee children hear, both about stories about their country of origin and stories here, and how do they resonate? What is their experience of those stories? And, you know, for some children who aren't exposed to really big challenges, children's literature provides this really safe space to explore difficult issues. But I think there are also important questions to ask for those children that have experienced really difficult challenges, that have confronted human rights violations. What does the experience of reading do for them as well? And there are many places we can go, and the only question is time, really.
In terms of making children aware of their rights through their consumption of the stories, what is your goal for that? I mean, in a perfect world, would a child say to a parent who is perhaps physically abusive, "You have no right to do that to me. I have the right to be told, but not slapped"?
Well, I would love to have that empowered child. I mean, human rights is about empowerment, so I think that would be wonderful. But I also don't want to put it on that child in that space, and that's a very difficult, traumatic experience. So I wouldn't expect, we shouldn't leave it just to the child. But I think the fundamental point for me is, how do we expect young adults or adults generally to exercise and realize their rights if we don't expose them to these ideas early? You don't just magically turn 18 and suddenly overnight wake up knowing about your rights and know how to realize them. You have to practice that as a child, and consistent with sort of developmental stage. But I think we want to give children opportunities, and that's what I hope through the book and, you know, as a parent.
Finally, Jonathan, would you tell us the quote from Nelson Mandela that's on your website about there can be no keener revelation
of a society's soul than how how they treat its children, how society treats its children. Yeah, I'm blanking on the quote at the moment, but I think that's really the essence of my work in this project.
Well, congratulations, bravo to you and Sarah on this book, which is Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination and the Narrative of Law, Oxford University Press. Jonathan Totteris is a law professor at Georgia State University, focusing on children's rights. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for hosting me.